Hi, this is Carl Weinschenk for the Daily Music Break. The Daily Music Break is at www.dailymusicbreak.com. Daily Music Break covers music across all eras and genres. Please check it out for great music, some context, playlists, podcasts like this one and others, and free email newsletters. We're thrilled today to be speaking with author and musician Larry Kerwin. Larry is with Black 47, and he's doing a lot of other stuff, so we're thrilled to be speaking to him. Good afternoon, Larry. How are you today?
Hey, Carl. How's it going, man?
Just great. I really appreciate you taking time out.
One little note before we start. Black 47 disbanded November 15th. So after 25 years, so just to bring up to date on that.
Okay, well, I'm going to ask you about that then, your feelings on that, but that's sure. That's good to know, and I should have checked that before I said it. But to start with, before we get there, Larry, could you tell folks where they can get a hold of your music?
Well, you can always go to black47.com, just black47.com. We have a shop there, and the 16 different albums that we recorded over the 25 years are on sale there, along with T-shirts and books and DVDs, all that type of thing. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, they're on Amazon and all the usual places, too.
Okay, great. And my understanding, I'm recording this on March 2nd. My understanding is you have a show coming up this weekend. Could you tell us a little bit about that, please?
Yeah, I'm out solo now. It'll actually be my first solo show in the U.S. Right after Black 47 disbanded in November, I did a solo show, a solo tour of Ireland. But this will be my first one in the U.S., and it's at the YMCA Bolton Center in Bayshore.
Okay.
At 8 o'clock on Saturday, the 7th of March. And I'll be doing the 17th of March, which is St. Patrick's Day, at the Cutting Room in New York City right after the parade at 7 p.m.
Oh, no, that should be fun. I always wanted to ask a musician this question. What's the difference between when you're associated with a band and you play with, a bunch of guys in a band? What is the difference really on going solo, maybe not emotionally or psychologically, but how is it different? It seems like there would be something to be said about that. What does it feel like?
Well, there's a huge difference, just sonic-wise. You're coming from a full, roaring six-piece band, and you're coming down to just yourself on stage. So you have to compensate for that. For me, because Black 47 was pretty, apart from music-driven, it was very lyric-driven, I've got to get more into what the songs are about. You tend to get deeper into the song in an odd way when you're on stage yourself, because you really are dependent on telling the lyrical story as much as the musical story. Whereas with a band, you're concentrating on the music too. The music is a huge part of it, or with me anyway.
Right.
So when I go solo, then I have to really, pull back the lyrics and see, where did the song come from, and get into the inner being of the song, as it were, the soul of the song.
Mm-hmm. Do you do a completely different set of songs? Is there overlap, or is it the same set list, the same songs?
Well, Black 47 never had a set list anywhere. We had about 200 songs that I wrote.
That's a lot of songs.
And we vary the set every night. So I'm kind of doing the same thing. I'm involved in musical theater too. So there's some songs from the musicals I've written, mm-hmm. particularly two musicals in the last couple of years. So I'll do a couple of songs from those. But in general, I'll be doing Black 47 songs and reinterpreting them, as it were.
Okay. Why did Black 47 call it quit? Well, before we get to that, this is a question I know you've been asked a million times, but people are going to be curious about it. What is the name Black? I know, but what is Black 47, the name?
It's the year 1847, which was the worst year of the Irish potato famine. Mm-hmm. So when they used the word black, it meant the darkest year, mm-hmm. Dark 47. Okay. So the band was political. Black 47 is and was, and I'm political. So it's very akin to the Jewish cry of never again,
mm-hmm.
that Jewish people use in relation to the Holocaust.
Right.
To say Black 47 means, you know, never let this disaster happen again. A million people died, over a million people, and over a million people emigrated within 3 years. So it was pretty catastrophic.
Mm-hmm. It's a good name for a band. So I was curious about it years ago, and I looked it up, you know, on wherever, Wikipedia, and I found out, I think it's a terrific name. Why did you guys call it quits after all these years?
It was like we decided about 15 months before it to do it. We'd done 16 albums, played 2,500 gigs, you know. It just felt like it was a good time to do it. So what we did was, for 15 months out, we toured continually and did two albums in that period of time. So we were ready to go. It was 25 years to the week exactly from our first date. Mm-hmm. So it was planned out. No big emotional reason. 25 years seemed like a good figure to do it. And it gave everybody time to decide what they wanted to do, mm-hmm. after the band. And so far it's been working out.
Might you play with those folks again, or do you think that's it?
Oh, we're the best of friends. There will be no more Black 47. Once you do a thing, I'm convinced you should just do it, and that's it. Move on, you know, and go to other
mm-hmm.
things. Otherwise, it's always lurking behind you, you know, whereas to me, it's just a great achievement what we did, and it's great memories, and that's it. It was a band of its time, and you know, time to do other things.
Mm-hmm. I read in the one thing I wanted to ask you. I read in the, I guess either the All Music or the Wikipedia entry on Black 47 that you guys were banned from CBGBs. Is that accurate? And if so, what was that all about?
Actually, I have a book coming out next week, and the answer is in there.
So you're not going to tell me.
You can find out through that. It's called A History of Irish Music, and it's not just Irish music, but it's from me growing up in Ireland and following music. Mm-hmm. You know, it is kind of about Irish music, but it's not, say, traditional Irish music. It's, you know, it's about Van Morrison and U2 are in there, and all the different bands that came out of it.
Mm-hmm.
Bands that I was affected by and bands that I knew, and anyway, it's coming out in a couple of weeks.
Do you have a website for it yet? So people.
Well, there'll be a Facebook page for it, but there'll be details of it on at black47.com also.
Okay. So bands go away, but websites don't, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. The website will go on because there's just so much interest in Black 47, and what we do is we put up different old recordings for people to download, and you know, there are a lot of different Facebook pages devoted to the band, 25 years of Black 47, and you know, the bands tend to kind of go on whether you're playing or not, you know, because especially you have so many CDs out there, so many songs.
What I used to say is Jimi Hendrix's death marked the midpoint in his career as far as albums go. Yeah,
hey, exactly. Yeah. I mean, who would forget Jimi? Yeah. He's still the man. Yeah.
He's still the man. When I read your bio on, I guess, Wikipedia, it described a guy who went very quickly from youth spent in, I would guess, and correct me if I'm wrong, rural Ireland, to kind of the center of the music scene in New York City. Very quickly, is that a fair assessment? And if so, like, what was that like? That must have been pretty odd.
Well, it was definitely, that was the case. Although I had lived in Dublin for a couple of years, so it was a bit of a jump. But to land in New York City in the mid-70s, right when CBGBs was happening, I mean, to me, at first, CBGBs was my local bar, even though, say, I saw the Ramones there on their first night, and I think I saw Talking Heads on their second night. You know, I saw all the bands. I mean, Television were my favorite bands. I was there every time they played. But it was a big jump. But, you know, New York is a very different place back then. It was a jump you could make without money. I mean, I arrived here with $100 and was able to stay alive and be a musician without really ever getting a job. Yeah. I don't think you could do that anymore. But it was a fun jump. You know, there was a lot of things happening. The arts were all colliding in Lower Manhattan and the East Village at that point. Mm-hmm. So it was always exciting, and new things were happening. You had to be open, though. You know, I came here for experience, to experience life, and I was open to everything that was going on. Mm-hmm. If you came and you were, you know, uptight about things, and it could have been a tough city for people. But to me, I'd seen Midnight Cowboy, and I wanted a piece of that.
Well, you ended up better than both those guys.
Yeah, I'm still kicking all right. That's one thing.
I just featured the song Everybody's Talking At Me at the website, and I was looking at some of the song. Music, you know, and Harry Nilsson didn't write it. It's funny, he was a great songwriter, but it was someone else's song. It was his biggest.
But he wrote a song for it, and they refused that song. He wrote, I guess the Lord Must Be in New York City, mm-hmm. was a song that he wrote for it, and they didn't like that. I don't understand why, because it's a great song. It's probably even more appropriate,
right.
But he'd already recorded Everybody's Talking, and they chose that instead. The two of them are great songs. So.
Yeah, I gotta listen to
Fred Neil's song, I think, isn't it? Everybody's Talking.
Yes, boy. So you know your movie music.
Yeah, I know. I'm a huge fan of Harry Nilsson's. In fact, I've been thinking a lot about Harry Nilsson because of the new Bob Dylan album, you know, of standards.
Right.
Harry Nilsson did one also that people have forgotten about that is just stunning, you know, of standards.
He was the best friend of all the Beatles. The Beatles loved Harry Nilsson.
Yeah, he was a musical genius, yeah. But a hard drinker, and sometimes they don't go together.
That doesn't end well. Is Irish music different? Is American Irish music different than Irish Irish music? Are they two different strands, Larry, of music, or are they really one thing and just being played on different sides of the Atlantic?
Well, it depends on what you're talking about. If you're talking about Irish traditional music, they're very much the same on both sides of the Atlantic, right? Yeah. If you're talking about Irish rock music, Irish rock music tends to be more influenced by American and English rock music. You know, so whatever is on the charts, that's what they're going to be playing in Ireland, right? Mm-hmm. But then there's a hybrid in between that, which, say, Black 47 and Flogging Molly and the Dropkick Murphys are kind of known for, which is a mixture of rock music and punk music mixed in with Irish traditional music. And that tends to be much more Irish-American, oddly enough, and which is surprising. You would think you would get that music in Ireland, but they don't seem to know how to mix that in Ireland. They did at one point with bands like Horselips, but it's very much an Irish American form now. And in the book, A History of Irish Music, I deal with that question specifically, the split between the two countries and, you know, how it came about, you know.
It's fascinating. Where do, and here's where I might start asking dumb questions. Where do the Pogues fit into all this? Do they?
Well, yeah, you're totally right. I left out the Pogues because I mentioned them a lot in the book too. You see, what happens is there's Irish traditional music, all right, and you can hear that in any part of Ireland, and it goes through the prism of being Irish, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, you take Irish traditional music and you put it into London, where North London, where the Pogues are from, right?
Yeah.
And it takes on the sheen of North London. So Shane McGowan, who's the lead singer, was very much into punk music, right? When it started, the Sex Pistols and the Clash and everything. So what he started to do was mixing Irish traditional music with the punk music, and then he's a brilliant songwriter. So Black 47 did the same thing in New York City. We took Irish traditional music and put it through the prism of New York City, which was reggae and funk and hip-hop and, you know, CBGBs. So that's what happened to the Black 47 music, you know, and why it's a bit different than the Pogues, you know?
And you, in terms of time, you guys were about the same time as them, or you were a bit after?
We're a bit after them, but luckily for me, when I came here first, I got a deal with Epic Records. It was a band called Major Thinkers, and we got dropped by the label in 1984. So we were with the label for 2 years or something like that. We got dropped in 84. And in 85, the band Major Thinkers broke up, and I left music totally at that point.
Mm-hmm.
I never listened to rock music. I went into theater and became a playwright. So I missed the whole Pogues beginning. And, you know, I knew about them, but I wasn't really interested in music at that point. So when we came to form Black 47, we weren't trying to be like the Pogues in any sense. Whereas most Irish American bands were very aware of the Pogues, and you can hear their, you can hear the influence in them. With Black 47, that's not the case. Even though I kind of grew up with more of Shane McGowan's influences than anyone else, because, you know, being from where I'm from is only about 150 miles from London, so I had the same influence as Shane, but because of getting out of the music, you know, when I came back into it, it was like, how do we get this to work with hip-hop and funk and reggae? We came into it a very different way, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And would, like, the more traditional guys, like the Clancy Brothers and those folks, did they like you guys? Were you guys like heretics? Was there a relationship?
It depended on how open they were, you know.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of them saw it as a threat, you know, that they were getting older and this new sound was coming in, and, you know, at the festivals people wanted to hear us.
Mm-hmm.
So there was, you know, anyone who felt that as a threat. But, you know, the more broad-minded ones, Liam Clancy liked what we did. Tommy Makem, say, hated it, you know. And, you know, I knew both of them well. And it was kind of interesting because I was friends with Tommy, but it was interesting sitting down and talking to him because I knew he hated what I did. You know, he didn't hate me.
Right. Well, at least he could make the distinction, right?
Well, some people are able to make that distinction, you know, and some people are not. And then there were other people who I would say, you know, if you're Irish, you kind of know the people. They're not going to, like, turn their back on you. But at the same time, it probably, you know, when I wasn't there, they were probably saying, I hate this bullshit, like, you know. But they never really said it to my face. But you could feel it, you know, among some of them. I didn't mind it, though. I understood what they were doing. We were this new thing, and we were loud. And you see, a lot of these bands came from very acoustic backgrounds.
Right, right.
Pete Seeger was a good friend of mine. Now, Pete didn't like electric music. You know? Right. He just didn't like it. That whole thing with between him and Bob Dylan at the Newport Festival, I could see why that happened, you know, because Pete just didn't like electric, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But he liked me as a person, and we were actually going to collaborate on a play idea of his
mm-hmm.
right before he died. So, you know, even though he didn't like what I did, he liked me as a playwright and was able to put aside the fact that, you know, I was rowdy electric guitar player, you know, and but he, you know, he liked the whole idea that we, that Black 47 was political. He just didn't like the sound of what we did.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to him it was like, why can't you do that with just an acoustic guitar? You know, people will hear what you're saying better. And in a certain way, at a point, you know, because I'm doing that now with the solo show. I'm practicing for it here now, and I realize that, you know, I was able to get away with a lot with Black 47 singing wise and delivering certain songs mm-hmm. that you can't get away with just an acoustic, you know?
Right.
I think that's what, say, the Clancy brothers and Pete Seeger, they could see that, you know? So mm-hmm. they're saying, why are you selling yourself short, you know? But they don't know the whole idea of what beat is, you know, like having a big band, rock and roll band behind you, how that turns on a lot of people, you know, turns on a lot of musicians, you know.
One of my favorite songs in the whole world, one of my favorite clips at my website, and I have about 2,000 clips up, is them singing Finnegan's Wake on the old David Susskind show.
They were actors, the Clancy brothers. They came here to be actors. They only slipped into music by they were playing in the back of the Lion's Head and the White Horse Pub in the West Village here in New York, and they weren't getting any acting jobs, and all of a sudden they started to get music jobs, and I thought, wow, you know, this is good. But they never lost that ability. I talked to Liam about it because I was good friends with Liam. He said everything they did on stage was practiced and rehearsed.
Mm-hmm.
It was never a second of spontaneity.
Mm-hmm.
They were actors. You know, they treated being on stage like being in a play, you know. So the repartee between the you know, between the different characters on stage, they could do the same show, you know, 300 days of the year and mm-hmm. not get tired of it because they were trained in to be an actor. For me, 2 days in a row, if I hear myself saying the same thing, you know, 3 days in a row, two I get away with, but 3 days in a row, I have to change it. Now, I may work my way back to the original way of saying the thing, but I can't actually bring myself to say that.
Mm-hmm.
Billy Bragg is a guy who can go on stage and he can give 10-minute speeches before every song,
right,
and deliver them perfectly and as if they're new. It takes a certain type of performer to be able to do that. I come more from the improv world. You know?
It sounds like that makes sense. You know, I wrote something here. It might be a little bit pretentious, but I just want to run it past you. I was thinking, you know, I've been wanting to interview you for the site for a long time, and I was thinking about why I connected to Irish music, because I'm not Irish, but I've been in and around New York my whole life, and I used to listen to a lot of Irish music, especially on college radio stations on Saturday mornings.
Yeah.
And I was thinking... Yeah, all of those. And I was thinking, besides the fact that it's great music, I think one of the things that I connected with is it was almost like it was music of a people in exile from Ireland, the New York scene, be they, you know, voluntary exile, economic exile, political exile, but it seemed almost like, you know, the hosts and the music were music from people who were longing for home, but they couldn't go there for some reason. I think I connected with that as much as with the music. Did he ever feel stuff like that, or was it just all in my imagination?
No, that's totally true. You know, more true than you probably imagine. The people who listen to those shows, and a lot of young people were raised up listening to them. You know, their parents had it on, and that was their introduction to Irish music too. But the parents, the people, the first generation and the second generation, you know, who've been to Ireland and miss it, those shows provide this great link for them, mm-hmm. where they're actually in Ireland when they're listening to it.
Right.
Even though they're 3,000 miles away, those shows are like lifeblood to them.
Right.
By the same extension, when Black 47 started, we got a huge audience of people who had grown up listening to those shows, but no longer could get into the style of music. They were into Irish music, but they found it old-fashioned. But they wanted Irish music that reminded them of Ireland,
mm-hmm.
that was in the beats and the rhythms that were current. So that was part of Black 47's success, being able to provide that, something modern, but at the same time with those links to Ireland or to the imagination of Ireland, maybe more than anything.
We are pushing up against a half an hour. We haven't even talked about your playwriting. I read, and I don't know how current this was, in one of the profiles, that you were writing a musical, and I'm probably going to mispronounce his name, but it's Thomas Keenerly, the guy who wrote Schindler's List, right?
Oh, Keenerly, yeah, that's the one.
Yeah. Well, how long ago was that?
It was running a year ago. It ran in New York for 6 weeks or whatever, something like that, at the Irish Rep.
What was it?
It was a musical called Transport, and it's about Tom Keneally's wife's great grandmother was sent from Ireland to Australia,
right,
with 100 other female prisoners, and she got sent for stealing a pound of butter. And she was sent for 7 years to Australia, but there was no returning. You couldn't come back. Basically, what the British did was they had founded a colony in what is now Sydney in Australia, and they had put all their male prisoners over there. They'd swept clean the jails because they needed people to work cheaply, but they hit a problem and they didn't have enough women. So they swept through Ireland and England, and any woman who was caught with any kind of crime was just transported there with the idea that they would seed a new colony out there. And they did. That's where Australians came from. Many of them were descended from those convict women and convict men. Mm-hmm. So Tom had this idea of doing a musical that would show what it was like to be sent to Australia. Mm-hmm. And I did the lyrics and the music for it.
Mm-hmm.
It's called Transport. And it'll probably run again at some point. But
beautiful.
Yeah.
But, you know, I could probably stay on with you for another half hour, but probably a half an hour is a good place to cut it off. Maybe we could do it again. But before we do hang up, please, Larry, provide that information on the show in Bay Shore again, if people might have missed it at the beginning.
Yeah, I'll be playing solo. It'll be my first American solo show after Black 47. It's disbanded in November. And I'll be at the Bolton Center, the YMCA Bolton Center in Bayshore. It's a beautiful theater. Black 47 played there a lot. And it's on this coming Saturday, March 7th. And I'll also be doing a show on St. Patrick's Night, March 17th, at the Cutting Room in New York City.
Yes.
So two solo shows coming up.
Great. Larry, I'd like to thank you very, very much. It's been a real pleasure finally speaking to you. It's been very interesting. Like I said, I'd like to do it again sometime.
Sure, Carl. It's a pleasure. And good luck to you and to all your listeners out there.
Okay. This is Carl Weinschenk for the Daily Music Break. Daily Music Break is at www.dailymusicbreak.com. We cover all music, regardless of era or genre. Please stop by, pick up to hear some good music, see good context around the music, listen to podcasts like this one, and listen to some playlists, and get free email newsletters. Thank you all very much for listening. Bye-bye. So hold on to your rifles, boys. Don't give up your dreams. Of a republic for the working class, economic.